Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Maddie.
Michael.
Okay, today we're talking about drugs of the anus.
Sorry?
Drugs of the anus. Specifically drugs of the penis.
Penis?
The autonomic nervous system, ANS, and parasympathetic nervous system.
PNS.
Yeah, PNS.
Oh, my bad.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. Today, we're talking about drugs of the cholinergic system. So, these are drugs of the parasympathetic nervous system.
Parasympathetic.
That's what I was saying.
Which is parallel to the sympathetic.
Is that what that means?
I think so.
Oh. And what when it says sympathetic, what are we referring to? Sympathy. How is it?
Your lack of.
True. So, we've already spoken about in previous episodes drugs of the sympathetic.
So we've done adrenergic receptors and adrenergic drugs.
So what's left?
We have done cholinergic receptors, and so we're left with cholinergic drugs.
All right. So when we talk about cholinergic drugs, we're referring to acetylcholine, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So when we look at acetylcholine, we know that it is a neurotransmitter.
Right.
It's a neurotransmitter that works within the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And it is one of the primary neurotransmitters for the autonomic nervous system, actually both for the sympathetic and parasympathetic system. So just as a quick recap.
And also skeletal muscles.
Yes. So acetylcholine tells skeletal muscles to contract, right?
More or less.
All right. Oh, with the help of calcium and ATP and so forth, and sodium influx, or action potential.
All right. Oh, yep.
Just showing off a little bit. So when we look at acetylcholine in the autonomic nervous system, the autonomic nervous system is basically talking about the automatic nervous system. That's
without your control of.
Yeah, sympathetic, which is.
Or conscious control of.
Sympathetic being.
Fight and flight.
And parasympathetic being.
Rest and digest.
All right. So both of them are two neuron chains coming out of the spinal cord. So that means.
Or brainstem.
Or brainstem. So it's going from the brainstem or spinal cord, then one neuron shoots out. It then throws a neurotransmitter to the second neuron, which then speaks to the effector target organ or gland.
Okay. And what are these effector or target glands in the parasympathetic nervous system if we're going to digest and rest?
Yes. Okay. Good work. Well, the effector organs can include... Do you want to do this top to toe?
Let's just stick with the digestion part. So, what are the things that you want to be activated? What are the effector organs?
Okay. So you didn't want me to structures? Go through the two neuron chain?
Not yet.
Okay.
So when we hear rest and digest, because I think it's easy for everyone when they hear fight and flight to think of everything that's happening, like heart rate goes up, breathing goes up, pupils get big, you've got more blood to muscles, you know, all that stuff. But when you're resting and digesting, so this is where you've just eaten a big meal and you're sitting down, resting.
Okay.
But let's stick with the digestion part to begin with. What are all the parts in your digestive tract that you want to make active?
Okay, well, you
want... And you can do that from top to toe if you want.
Okay, so...
Or mouth to anus.
I'll leave that. So, we want secretions to occur.
Right.
So, these are going to be digestive secretions. These are going to be enzymes. These are going to be various chemicals. These are going to be mucus secretions. Anything that can aid the digestive process. Right?
Okay.
So, that can include what's being released at the stomach or at the small intestines and even at the large intestines. There's not as many digestive enzymes. Well, at the mouth. True. At the mouth is probably where we should start because you take a burger in and we're going to release saliva.
Okay. So, salivation is one.
Salivation. Yeah.
There's going stomach.
To be enzymes. Stomach, well, has its own type of salivation, but it's mucus that's been released.
Okay, anything else?
And a whole bunch of digestive enzymes, so, mainly those for protein.
So, acid and pepsinogen.
Yep.
Okay, small intestine?
Small intestines has, well, basically releases all three digestive enzymes that break down proteins, fats, and carbs.
Okay.
Via its conversation with the pancreas, and also releases a bunch of hormones that can trigger... everywhere else in the digestive system to start kicking up.
Okay. And what about just the movement through? How do you move everything through?
Well, it's a big, long, hollow pipe from mouth to anus. Mm-hmm. And
so now we go back to mouth and anus.
Sorry. Yeah, well, you said mouth to anus. I'm saying mouth from mouth to anus. Damn, I said it too. Sorry. surrounded by a hollow muscular tube. Smooth muscle, and so in order for things to move through, the process of contraction and relaxation in a patterned wave-like fashion.
Like a walking caterpillar.
Yeah, or when you push a tennis ball through a sock.
As you do.
It's termed peristalsis.
Okay, and so you basically need to contract smooth muscles to do this.
Yes.
So you could be correct by saying, in parasympathetic rest and digest, you are contracting smooth muscles to move the food along.
And increasing the release of digestive secretions.
Okay, but there are some muscles that you do need to relax, not contract.
Yeah, I suppose the gatekeepers, which are the sphincters, they are basically the gatekeepers of movement throughout your GIT, well, and other structures, and they separate one structure from another. So
there's a few. There's upper and lower esophageal, there's the ileocecal, and there's probably then the rectal or anal.
There's a couple there.
Which, in the case of this, is probably more so the internal.
Yes.
Because external the external, conscious. You've got conscious control over. So, these relax.
Or at least I like to think I do.
Mm-hmm. So, these relax.
Yes.
So, this is all that's happening to the digestive. So, when you think parasympathetic, everything we just spoke about then is what's occurring.
Yeah.
Okay. The other, and so we got digestion and evacuation with the GIT. But we've also got, and secretion. And then the other kind of... thing that's happening down that end of town is the urinary.
Yeah.
Okay, so your bladder is just a storage device for urine.
Yeah.
And when you are resting in digestion, this is probably the goal here is probably to allow you to evacuate it. Not all the time.
Empty the storage unit.
Empty the storage unit. So you want to contract your bladder and you want to release the sphincters.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
kidneys, absolutely. Not so much. I mean, you could probably argue parasympathetic is probably going to give greater kidney blood flow and so forth than sympathetic, but it's kind of done on its own more so. But the parasympathetic control of the urinary system is more contracting the bladder and releasing the sphincters.
Okay.
For the urination side of things.
Perfect.
Is that fair?
I think that's great.
Okay, so that's two done.
Yeah.
Any other systems in the parasympathetic in rest and digestion you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I think just very briefly, when we talk about parasympathetic, it's about maintaining homeostasis in that time of resting and digesting. So other things that do happen, which may not contribute significantly to the digestion role, but do occur under parasympathetic control, includes constriction of your pupils.
Okay.
It includes lacrimation.
So, crying.
Yep. It includes a slowing down of your heart rate.
Okay. Because you probably just don't need as such a forceful heartbeat and a quick heartbeat while you're sitting eating.
It includes a slight constriction of the musculature in your airways.
So the bronchioles?
Yeah.
Less air, less oxygen.
And anything else you can think of? I think that covers the predominant effects, right?
I'm not sure if it's more of a lack of sympathetic or a parasympathetic effect, but you probably have changes in muscle tone within the blood vessels.
So you'd have more blood going to your gut, which you'd want, and probably more going to your skin, so you can probably thermoregulate.
So you may look flushed if you activate the parasympathetic nervous system too much.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't really comment on that.
Yes, the answer is yes. With some of these drugs that we're going to talk about, it can lead to flushing.
Okay.
Yeah, because of that effect of dilating.
So I must be just constantly in a rest and digest state.
Yeah, at least your hair is. All right, Matsuranga. So that is talking about the parasympathetic nervous system.
And kind of everything it does.
Yes. Now, the next thing you should be aware about the parasympathetic nervous system is that we also term it the craniosacral system, because you can divide where those neurons that come out of the brain or spinal cord come out for the parasympathetic nervous system. They either come out at the level of the brain stem or at the level of the sacrum. Now, that's why it's called craniosacral. Now, if you look at the nerves that come out the level of the brain stem, they're going to be cranial nerves. By definition, they have to.
And you've got 12 of them.
Yes. 12 pairs. There's only four that come
out. So, not all of them?
No. Not all
of them. So, just a handful of your 12 are parasympathetic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those are... Okay, I'm going to test you. Cranial nerve 3, what is it?
Ocular motor.
All right. Cranial nerve 7 then?
Facial.
All right. 9.
Glossopharyngeal.
All right, and cranial nerve 10.
The wanderer.
Okay, the vagus. Yeah. So these are the four cranial nerves that are involved in the parasympathetic nervous system. So let's just quickly have a look. Number 3, which is ocular motor, what's its function?
Specifically parasympathetic?
Yeah, let's just talk about that.
Pupil lens.
Okay, so constriction of the pupils, that's probably the primary effect, right? What about facial?
Salivation, lacrimation.
Yep. And what about glossopharyngeal? Salivation as well.
Yeah, parotid. Parotid.
Yep. And vagus?
This is everything else, really.
Yeah, everything parasympathetic.
Up to the... Well, at least for the GIT. So
up to pooping and peeing.
It stops at the point of the, let's just say, the splenic flexure of your transverse colon.
Oh, that helps everyone. So
all your gut...
The last third of your large bowel.
All your gut, except the last third of your... And that's because that's the last part, including your urinary system, which is sacral.
Yeah.
And that's 3, 4, 5. No, 2, 3, 4.
Keeps poo off the floor.
Or pee.
And... pee. So you could basically say that
it's vagus, 2, 3, 4 keeps poo off the floor.
So you could say that vagus is the main parasympathetic nerve for everything parasympathetic
outside your head.
Outside your head, excluding pooping and peeing.
I mean, the last act, you mean? Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
The last act. Shakespeare's final act. So pooping and peeing. That's the cranio side. And the sacral side, like you just said, everything after the splenic flexure has to do with the last aspects of pooping and peeing. All right. Now let's talk about the receptors, which we have done. Mm-hmm. But it's good to just do a super quick recap of the receptors of the parasympathetic nervous system. But to talk about that, we need to talk about that two-neuron chain of the parasympathetic nervous system.
Brilliant.
So the first neuron that's coming out of the cranio area or the sacral area needs to speak to a second neuron, and it does it by releasing a neurotransmitter.
Yep.
Now, the neurotransmitter that's released will always be acetylcholine, and it will bind to a receptor that's specific for acetylcholine, and that's always going to be nicotinic.
Okay, and we're just talking parasympathetic at the moment.
Just talking parasympathetic.
So this would be a nicotinic N, which is nicotinic nerve.
Okay, is that what it means?
It's just the name they give the receptor.
Okay. Now, once that acetylcholine's been thrown from the first neuron to the second neuron, or what you could say is from the pre-ganglionic neuron to the post-ganglionic neuron, the post-ganglionic neuron, or the second neuron, will continue its signal and then will be innervating Sorry?
To the effector.
Yes, it'll innervate an effector. And that effector is going to be all those organs are just all organ systems we've spoken about for the parasympathetic nervous
system. And where they communicate is usually in a collection, which is the ganglion.
Yes.
And because it's parasympathetic, we've probably already done this in the autonomic or the parasympathetic section of the autonomic, but just so we, whilst it's here, this ganglion is very close to the effector.
Yes.
Unlike the sympathetic, which is at the chain.
Yes.
Which is near the spinal cord.
Paravertebral.
Paravertebral. So if this was, let's say, going to the lacrimal gland, the actual ganglion's very close to the gland.
Gotcha.
Okay. Sorry.
That's okay. Good. So when the second neuron needs to talk to this gland, whether it's the lacrimal gland or the stomach or whatever it may be, it needs to release another neurotransmitter. And again, it's acetylcholine.
Okay.
And acetylcholine this time doesn't bind to nicotinic receptors. It binds to muscarinic receptors. Right. Now, predominantly, you can make an argument that there are both nicotinic and muscarinic receptors on some of these effectors. But today, we're going to simplify it. And we're going to focus on muscarinic because that's predominantly the receptor that's present.
Okay.
Sounds good. So what we're talking about today with cholinergic drugs is mainly certain drugs that mimic acetylcholine or change the levels of acetylcholine at the muscarinic receptors. You okay with that?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
All right. So what are the muscarinic receptors, Matt? How many are there?
There's five. Unlike adrenergic, which is typically four, which is the alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. There's probably beta 3 as well, right? So there's probably five there as well.
But no drugs affect it. So who gives flying?
Muscarinic. So M1, M2, M3, M4, and M5.
All right.
So
they're all motorways.
Yeah, in Sydney.
Yeah.
Okay.
M1.
Well, let's just say we can, just for today, we'll exclude M4 and M5.
For what reason?
I think they're similar to the adrenergic beta-3. I think they're just less commonly used, so it's best just to take them out for today.
Okay, so
you said... Are you happy with that?
Yeah.
So basically, just like the M4 brain mostly, and same with the M5 mostly in the brain. Arguably other places, but they're the main types. So let's just exclude them for today's discussion and we'll focus on M1, M2, and M3.
Okay.
Are you happy with that?
Yes.
Yeah, just to make it easy for listeners.
All right.
Particularly students who are preparing for things or exams. We'll just keep it to M1, M2, M3.
Now, when we spoke about sympathetic receptors, we help students remember them by saying that some, if you throw adrenaline at them, some are excitable and some... Some excite and some inhibit.
Yeah.
Is it the same with cholinergic?
More or less. So the receptor, because it's water soluble, I assume, it has a receptor on the outside of the cell. I think they're all G protein receptors. Some will respond with more calcium essentially going into a cell. So if it's a muscle, we know if you have more calcium going to a muscle cell, you get contraction.
Mm-hmm.
And there is one type which is actually inhibiting calcium release. So that would actually inhibit the response. So when we think of what you just asked, M1 and M3 excite, okay? So you're going to have more calcium in the cell. So you're going to have a excitatory response. And M2, you're going to see an inhibitory response.
And I think that's a good point to make because what you want to think about is when you throw a positive ion... Because calcium is Ca2+, right? It's an ion. It's positively charged. When you throw a positively charged ion into a cell, you're changing the resting membrane potential into an excitatory phase.
Yep.
And this is what's basically happening. So if you do anything to increase the movement of positive ions into a cell, it's going to be excitatory. Right. Okay. That's a blanket statement that we can make. There's going to be exceptions to this rule, but this is important in this case. When you throw calcium in, it's excitatory. If you inhibit calcium, it's going to be inhibitory. And this is what we're talking about with these three receptors. M1, excitatory, throws calcium in. M2, inhibitory, blocks calcium from going in. M3, excitatory, throws calcium in.
Okay, so now let's put all those organs and body parts that we spoke about at the start on what's happening when you're rested in digestion.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we can line up each M1, M2, M3 and where they're actually happening. So M1, it's happening mostly at parietal cells, which you know are at the stomach.
Yes.
So if you excite them, what's going to come out?
Acid. Hydrochloric acid.
And do you want that when you're resting on digestion?
Yes, you do want that because it's going to help denature proteins.
Great. So that makes sense. The other one that could be at M1 is the CNS. So sometimes they might the central nervous system? The brain.
Okay.
It's probably throughout, but let's just keep it for the brain today.
All right.
Neurons in the brain.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah, neurons in the brain do need acetylcholine because it plays an important role with solidifying synaptic conversations, creating memories.
Okay.
All that type of stuff.
All right. M2. Yeah. So what did you remember from M2? Is it excitatory or inhibitory?
It's inhibitory.
Okay. So now the first thing you've got to think of is what in the parasympathetic would you like to inhibit?
That's a good way of
thinking. Okay. So heart.
Yeah. You would inhibit the heart because you want it to slow down.
And contract less forcefully.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you want to inhibit in the rest and digest?
I think the only thing we spoke about was that when we looked at the digestive system, we want to activate everything, activate the muscles, activate the secretions, but you said we need to inhibit the gatekeepers being the sphincters to allow the movement of things from one structure to the next.
Yeah.
So you'd want to relax sphincters.
Yeah.
Good. Does that mean M2 receptors predominantly are on the heart and the sphincters are the GIT?
Probably also the urinary.
Okay, cool. All right.
Okay. Probably there is amongst other ones as well, but that's the main ones, I think.
Yep.
M3, so this is excitatory.
Yep.
And this acts on many smooth muscles. So we have smooth muscles in your bronchioles.
Airway.
So if you contract those, what happens to the the diameter of your bronchioles?
They become less patent, Matthew. They become more constricted.
So a smaller diameter.
Yes.
That means less air comes through. That means you have bronchoconstriction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That makes sense?
Makes sense.
Okay. In your pupils, so remember back to the sympathetic, we said that in your iris, the body of your iris, you kind of have two groups of muscles. You have one that are the kind of radiating fibers that pull on each dimension, each part of the pupil. And if you pull on every little part of the pupil and stretch it out, the pupil will dilate, okay? But in the parasympathetic part, you've also got a constrictor, a sphincter constrictor. And so this is the one that's getting activated. So you're getting pupil constriction here.
Okay. So bronchoconstriction, pupil constriction.
Yep. Basically, all the smooth muscle in your GIT tract.
Okay.
So that's going to be for peristalsis. Also, your detrusor muscle, which is located where?
At the bladder.
Okay.
Squeezes the pee out of the bladder.
Yeah. But not the bladder neck. The bladder neck is, if you contract that, that's actually more sympathetic. So you're going to hold on to things.
All right.
But that's not for this case. The detrusor just generally is going to contract in parasympathetic.
All right.
Uterus. So you can will contract the uterus, particularly in childbirth. That's parasympathetic. And then all the glands that we spoke about earlier. Also M3. So M3 does a lot.
Okay.
And you can probably imagine if you throw in a drug that acts on M3, you're going to get a lot of side effects.
Yeah.
So, for instance, if you want to... let's say you got glaucoma, all right, which is a high pressure in the front of your eye, and you want to use a muscarinic drug, you don't want to probably give it orally, right? Because you're going to get all those side effects that all the effects that we just spoke about.
Yep.
It's going to affect the heart. It's going to affect the uterus if you're a female. It's going to affect your bladder, your GIT, your bronchioles. And if you just want to target your eye, you don't want to do all that stuff, right?
Exactly.
Make sense?
Yep.
All right.
Let's move on because that was a recap. That was a nice big recap, but at least you know about the muscarinic receptors.
Okay, so now we go to the drugs.
All right.
And so there's essentially two ways to remember it. There's the agonists, which is the activators, and the antagonist.
Yep.
Okay, so let's start with the agonist.
Can I just say that when we look at the drugs, that while we do have agonists and antagonists, there's very few antagonists. So predominantly, we're going to be focusing on agonists today.
Right.
And we'll finish off with some antagonists. And when we look at agonists, you can break it up into two major classes.
Okay.
So you got direct acting agonists. Now, what would that mean to you if I said direct acting?
Acting directly on the receptor.
Yeah. So basically, the direct acting agonists mimic acetylcholine.
Okay.
So they pretend to be acetylcholine and activate the same receptors as acetylcholine.
Okay.
And then the indirect acting, what do you think?
Don't act on the receptor.
No, that's right. So what they do is they increase the availability of existing acetylcholine.
Right.
At the receptor.
They don't necessarily jump on the receptor, but they somehow make more acetylcholine just available?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
At the synapse.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's start with direct.
Okay.
Because that seems pretty straightforward.
So direct acting. Now.
So these bind directly to the receptor, which we spoke about. Let's say in the context of M1, M2, M3.
Okay. Yep.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, I think we have to start with acetylcholine.
Okay.
Right? So acetylcholine is going to be the main direct acting chemical.
Mm-hmm.
However, acetylcholine isn't very useful therapeutically. And that's what we're talking about today. Acetylcholine actually doesn't last very long within the system because the enzymes that sit at the synapse gobble it up and recycle it pretty quickly. So acetylcholine, really isn't used. So what they did was they started to create drugs that looked and sounded and tasted like acetylcholine.
Tasted?
Well, maybe. That's what they used to do back in the day. A lot of these drugs were created in the early 1900s. And one of the ways that they used to determine what type of drug they were was to taste it.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So probably the first one we should talk about, which is very similar to acetylcholine, is methanocholine.
Right.
It's basically acetylcholine, but it lasts a lot longer. And you only need like 1/200th the amount of acetylcholine to do the same effect.
All right.
So that's methanocholine.
Mm-hmm.
There's carbachol and bethanacol as well.
Okay.
These are probably the three top direct acting, what we term choline esters, which mimic acetylcholine. Methanocholine, carbachol, and bethanacol.
So bethanacol is probably one just to note because it is used pharmacologically, predominantly in some cases of urinary retention and where you have kind of a slow bowel after surgery.
Yeah, bethanacol seems to be more M3 specific.
Okay.
What you'll find with a lot of these cholinergic drugs is that unlike the sympathetic, there's a lot of overlap when it comes to what receptors these drugs hit. So specificity is not as great as that of the adrenergics. And so what you'll find is methanacol, carbachol, bethanacol don't just hit multiple muscarinic receptors. Some of them actually also hit nicotinic receptors at the preganglionic neuron.
Okay. Right?
So that means it can slightly activate a little sympathetic activity. When we look at bethanacol, like I said, it's more so M3 specific, while the others aren't necessarily. And carbachol and bethanacol seem to be quite resistant to acetylcholine esterase. These are the enzymes that gobble up and recycle acetylcholine at the synapse.
Okay, all right.
So, and because of its effect at M3, bethanacol, that's where it has that effect for, you know, non-obstructive urinary retention, for example.
And that would just mean, like, in a case, not so much obstructive would be like prostate enlargement.
Mm.
Okay, so it's probably less useful in that case.
Yeah.
We probably,
because the rate limiter is the prostate, not the diameter of the musculature in the tube. Okay.
So there's other drugs. I think we spoke about it. the alpha drugs within adrenergic, which is probably more useful for the obstructive urinary retention.
Yeah.
And also, as I said, sometimes you can develop a condition called post-operative ileus, which is your peristalsis in your bowel is decreased. So you want to encourage peristalsis, and that's where bethanacol may be used.
Okay.
Probably just put one example of an alkaloid in the direct acting.
Can I just quickly finish off with one more important point?
Yep.
When you look at carbachol and bethanacol, what you'll find is that the carbachol and bethanacol together, they increase muscular tone, increased peristaltic activity, increased GIT secretions, and that urinary effect as well. But it has very little cardiovascular effect. So, because you always think about, oh, it's going to affect all the different structures, but really has not much of cardio.
So that must be because it's more specific to M3, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. So the alkaloids are another type of direct acting, you said. What was one that you wanted to talk about?
Well, the main one I've got listed is pilocarpine.
Yeah.
And that can be used in glaucoma. Mm. So this is where you have high pressure in the front of your eye. And this is one of the biggest causes of blindness in the world. And so the main treatment options for...
Is that called glaucoma?
That's glaucoma.
Okay, yeah.
So glaucoma is just a high pressure. It can be an open or a closed angle glaucoma. But it's just a high pressure in the front of the eye, mm-hmm. which then can cause damage to the back of the eye. And so the treatments that can be used for glaucoma can range from prostaglandin analogues, beta blockers, which we saw when we did the adrenergic, and also alpha-2 agonists, because we know alpha-2 is that inhibiting one in the adrenergic, but also the cholinergic agonists. So pilocarpine can be used, I'm assuming, in a drop form, topical form, so you're not ingesting it or getting an IV. You're just getting it dropped onto your eyeball.
So it's a mitotic agent.
Yeah. So... what does that mean?
Meiotic.
Okay.
Meiotic agent, I should say.
Which means it induces meiosis.
Yep.
Which means
pupil constriction. Yeah.
Which my understanding of how that helps is, I'm just trying to think now. I think the way that the muscles work in the eye, if you constrict them, no, if you dilate them, and pull all those strings of the pupil.
Mm.
As you pull all the strings in, the muscles bunch up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that makes it harder for the fluid in the front of your eye to kind of move through.
Yep.
So the flow is poor. But if you constrict them, I think it stretches those muscles out.
Smoother surface for the movement.
And it allows greater flow through the ducts of the eye.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's pilocarpine, you said.
Pilocarpine. Yep.
So pilocarpine, like you said, predominantly used for ophthalmic.
Well, that's the one I know. I mean, there's probably other.
Well, it does uses. Have a number of other effects. I mean, they historically, when they injected it hypodermically at certain concentrations, it made the individual produce between 2 to 3 liters of sweat.
Oh, wow.
So that's how good it is at promoting sweating.
So area or through the whole body?
I don't know. Wow. But 2 to 3 liters of sweat, isn't that insane? It also, I read, it contracts the musculature of the spleen and could be responsible for leukocytosis, which seems to be observed when pilocarpine is given systemically.
Right. Is it given systemically pharmacologically?
As far as I'm aware,
from a clinical standpoint,
I don't know. There might be a situation in which it is given outside of ophthalmic scenarios, but I'm not aware.
Well, I think that there's an example here. It's used in Sjögren's syndrome.
Oh yeah, when you can't salivate appropriately.
Yeah, I think that's particularly a condition where people have problems with dry eyes, dry throat, cough a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
That's definitely one of the scenarios.
So, again, I'm not sure how they give that, whether it's, again, topical or orally. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. But at least that's what this particular drug does. Okay, so these are the direct acting.
Okay, so I think we've covered the main ones. There's probably many more that can be used, but these are the ones that I found.
Well, all the others are variations on a theme. These are the ones, you know, you look at the choline esters, the ones that sort of mimic acetylcholine. It's not really acetylcholine, but it's methanocholine, carbachol, bethanacol. And then the alkaloids, which are still quite similar.
And so the main one is
pilocarpine.
So muscarine come from this one?
Muscarine is also an alkaloid.
And so that's where the muscarinic receptors were first known, from muscarine?
It came from a derivative of mushrooms.
Mushrooms, yeah. Okay. So that mushroom, presumably they ingesting them, that mushroom caused a direct acting parasympathetic effect.
Flushing, sweating. forth. Yeah.
Interesting.
So let's look at the indirect acting. Okay. Now, when we said indirect, we said it increased the availability of already existing acetylcholine at the receptor,
okay.
which means that we need to talk about very briefly the fact that when acetylcholine is released from the presynaptic neuron,
yep.
and...
But I think also in this context, sorry to be annoying, but a lot of the context here is more at the skeletal muscle as well.
Can be.
Yeah, because a lot of the clinical objectives here is in a condition, well, just at the skeletal muscle level, but keep going.
So it can be at the skeletal muscle, but also within the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yep.
But what we need to be aware of is regardless, when acetylcholine is released by the neuron, it exists at the synapse for okay. a fraction of time.
All right, so it runs across from the neuron to the other neuron or the other effector and just jumps onto the receptor, like jumping on a seat.
Mm-hmm.
To then call it an activation to that effector or to the next neuron.
It's a okay. very fast game of musical chairs where if you don't have a chair, you quickly get pulled out of the game.
Okay. And so does this enzyme that's pulling you out of the game, does it pull you off the receptor as well? Or just cut you in half when you're in the synapse?
So once you've bound to the receptor, it does change the neurotransmitter and binding to the receptor is reversible and then it does get... recycled by the enzyme.
Okay, so just to clarify, and I'm not sure if you know it, I don't know the answer to this. So as ACH runs across the synapse,
so that's acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine, and it jumps on the receptor.
Yep.
Whilst it's on the receptor, which is causing a response, does the enzyme pull it off?
I would say,
or just wait for it to come up and then it cuts it in half.
Definitively, I don't know, but I would say it does enzymatically degrade it while it's on the receptor.
Really?
I would say so.
What a mean enzyme.
Yeah. And so what ends up happening is that what it does is it basically chops it up.
And what is this enzyme again?
This is called acetylcholine,
yeah.
unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
Esterase.
Esterase.
So the A's tells you it's an enzyme and it chops it up.
Okay.
And it chops it up into various components. Some are recycled. Some go elsewhere in the body. We don't really need to
I think
to
it's just choline and acetate.
That's right. And... what it does is it basically reduces the amount of acetylcholine available at the synapse.
Okay.
Therefore, if we want to increase the availability of acetylcholine at the synapse, we need acetylcholine esterase inhibitors, also termed anticholinesterases.
Brilliant. So all you're doing with these drugs is either... I remember my pharmacology teacher said this... if you think of the enzyme like a dog,
yeah,
okay, you can either just distract the dog for a bit, so you pull the dog away and then you play ball with it,
yeah,
or you can poison it and kill it.
Gotcha.
And so there's two ways.
Yeah.
You can either reversibly.
Which one do you do?
You can either reversibly affect the dog.
Yeah.
And so it'll eventually come back and do its job.
Yeah.
Of rounding up the. ACH like or the sheep. I think you use sheep. Or you can kill the dog with a poison bit of meat. And that's irreversibly. So now
so
it's gone for
that,
good.
So is this analogy basically stating that of the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors,
yeah.
you can have some that are reversible and some that are irreversible?
Correct.
Okay. So do you want to start talking about the reversible ones?
Okay. So these
so
are
we're
the
just
ones
distracting the dog.
This is just distracting the dog. And again, just to, if you're just starting to listen here, which I'm not sure why you'd be doing that because it's not a radio. Anyway, if you're using a reversible and you're using the dog analogy is referring to the enzyme.
Yeah. I think everyone got that.
Okay. So we're just distracting the dog with these drugs.
All right. So
do you want to list these drugs?
Yeah, so I think some of the physostigmine is probably the most common or most notable.
Or neostigmine.
Yeah, or neostigmine. And pyridostigmine as well.
Okay. So,
like but there's also rivastigmine too, odinepazil.
Like I said before when I stated that these can be also commonly used on skeletal muscles.
Yeah.
There is a condition where they're commonly used, which is called myasthenia gravis.
All right.
And so this is probably an autoimmune disease where the autoimmune action is to kill off ACH receptors.
At whereabouts?
On the skeletal muscle.
Oh, okay.
And so
you're losing the amount of skeletal muscle or receptors on the skeletal muscle. And as you said earlier, you need the receptors for ACH to bind, which opens up sodium, which then tells calcium to be released, which then causes muscle.
So does that mean people with myasthenia gravis, what one of the main symptoms is weakness, muscle weakness?
Yeah. Specifically like ongoing contractions. So I remember when I did a PBL in medicine, the example was it was happening to a lady in this case when she was hanging out the washing.
Yeah.
So at the start she could do it, but as she was pulling clothes and hanging up on the washing line and putting it above her head, she started to get weaker and weaker and weaker until she couldn't contract anymore.
Wow.
And she had to go and sit inside.
Wow.
Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So
absolutely.
You just don't have enough receptors to be functional to cause you to have adequate contraction.
Okay.
So what this is going to do is just to overload the synapse with heaps of ACH.
So that whatever receptors are left...
It's just heaps of them.
Yeah, it will actually continue to stimulate those because you've got different... Yeah, okay. So you don't actually need all the receptors available to tell a muscle to contract. You need a subset of them to be available but continually stimulated.
Mm. Now, this is probably only going to work for a period of time and then... I don't know. I mean... Presumably, the autoimmune condition continues and then you go into get worse and worse.
Yeah, I think it results in respiratory failure.
Maybe there is immune modulators now that can stop that. I'm not sure. But okay. Neostigmine, I just remember neostigmine is a very important drug in this space.
Okay. Are there any other scenarios that we can use these reversible indirect, or let's just say these reversible acetylcholinesterase inhibitors?
The other one that I'm aware of that I've learned is Donepezil.
Is what?
Donepezil.
Donepezil?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just...
You poor thing.
You know how I remember this when I learnt this drug?
Yeah.
Done puzzle. Like, I finished the puzzle. And so, to do puzzles, you need a lot of cognitive function.
Gotcha.
And so, this drug is good for Alzheimer's.
Yeah, so is rivastigmine. That's a big one for dementia as well.
That's the only reason why I remembered it like that.
All right, well, let's quickly talk about that. So, rivastigmine and donepezil is used in... cases of dementia, Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And so the role of acetylcholine with Alzheimer's is the fact that when you look at the central nervous system, acetylcholine is required to solidify synapses and to promote memory, recall, cognitive capacity, and so forth. When you have dementia, or Alzheimer's, you lose neurons. Neurons die, they disappear, and you actually lose brain mass. And in losing brain mass, you lose the capacity to release acetylcholine, and therefore you get a reduction in acetylcholine. Now, the reduction can result in the memory issues and reduction in cognitive capacity. Therefore, what we need to do is increase the amount of acetylcholine available to help promote all those things.
Yep.
Therefore, we use acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like rivastigmine and donepezil.
Okay, brilliant.
Thank you.
But again, I think that will slowly diminish over time. And then as the dementia worsens, then the function or the efficacy of this drug is diminished.
Yep. Now, there's like neostigmine, for example, has been used to reverse muscle paralysis after surgery.
Oh, okay.
And has also been used to promote bowel movement in people with spinal cord injury.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that would be non-obstructive.
Yes.
Okay, brilliant.
So... how about we look at the irreversible?
So this is where you kill the dog.
Right. So, in the analogy. Okay, good.
Not these drugs used to kill dogs.
No, please. This is not something that we support. But to continue Matt's analogy, the irreversible acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, once you pop them in...
So, the dog analogy here is the enzyme.
Okay. Sorry, let me apologize to everyone for Matt. I may need to find some irreversible acetylcholinesterase inhibitors to give him. They're actually horrible. They are longer lasting. They're not really used clinically. They are, or at least in the first instance, were produced as insecticides. Because I want you to think about this. When you give...
organophosphates.
When you give an organism an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor that's long lasting, you get a prolonged parasympathetic effect. Now, this leads to something called dumbbells.
Right.
And I think we may have spoken about dumbbells in the previous...
The gym. Oh, sorry.
So the, no, not the gym dumbbells. Dumbbells is D-U-M-B-B-E-L-S. And what that stands for is the D stands for diarrhea.
Yep.
The U for urination. The M for meiosis. The B.
Cable constriction.
Yep. The B for bradycardia.
Slow heart.
The B for bronchoconstriction.
It's evident.
The E for emesis.
Is that vomiting?
Correct.
Okay.
L for lacrimation.
Crying.
And S for salivation. So, if you were to give somebody an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor or anticholinesterase, that's irreversible, meaning long term, these things kick into action and these things will kill you if extended over time.
Okay.
They are used predominantly as insecticides, or at least were in their first iteration of production.
I think they still are.
They still are.
Yeah.
But then when war occurs, they go, okay, military warfare is kicking in. They started to use these things as like nerve gases.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like sarin. Sarin is probably one of the most notable nerve gases and is deadly, absolutely deadly. World War II was its primary production.
I think sarin was the one that was used in the Tokyo metro.
May have been.
And I think, was this in Iraq as well, Saddam?
Did he potentially use sarin? I don't know what they used, but they were nerve gases.
Okay.
So, I think we've gone through, what we've gone through is we've reintroduced the parasympathetic nervous system, spoke about its craniosacral nerves coming out and the organs it affects. We spoke about the receptors again. We recapped what the receptors were, where they acted. We spoke about the agonists for acetylcholine. So we spoke about direct acting and indirect acting. And we spoke about reversible and irreversible indirect acting. But what we need to finish on are the antagonists.
I just read very quickly on a particular page, organophosphate poisoning, which I'm not sure how common it is now. Farmers could get it if they've sprayed without protection.
Yeah.
And so a common presentation is that they would present with increased secretions.
Yep.
Fasciculations of their muscles.
Okay.
So this is just involuntary muscle contraction. Pinpoint pupils.
Yep.
Distinct smell. I'm not sure if that's from the gas or from their own body secretions.
Yep.
And chest crackles and ronchi, which is indicative of wheezing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. The antagonists.
So that would all make sense for me. And then they can go into a coma.
Yep.
So that would make sense from everything we spoke about. Sorry. So now we go to the antagonist, which is the blockers.
Yes. So if you're going to block acetylcholine, what you'll end up doing is basically mimicking the sympathetic nervous system.
Okay.
Right? So these are also known as sympathomimetics. They mime the sympathetic nervous system.
Right.
And there's only one really. I mean, it's called atropine.
Oh, there's a couple.
Well, all based upon belladonna, which means beautiful woman in Italian. And it comes.
So why would you be a beautiful woman if you took this?
Because it came from a plant termed belladonna. Because women back in medieval Italy used to take this plant,
right?
And they used to ingest it.
Yeah.
And
I'm waiting for how this makes you beautiful.
Because it makes your pupils significantly dilate.
Oh right.
And that was known as a term of beauty with dilated pupils. However, a lot of these women didn't know where they were going, so they would bump into a bunch of stuff.
Would it do anything else? I just can't think of the top of my head, besides causing you to get big probably pupils.
Sweat and salivate.
No, they'd probably be
drooling everywhere.
That.
Oh, so, of course. Sorry. Increased heart rate was a big one.
Still thinking how that makes you beautiful. Would it give you
It's just the pupil effect.
Not flushing or anything?
No. Potentially flushing, but that's more of a parasympathetic.
Or maybe you're white.
Could be the pale.
Yeah, would that make...
Could be the pale skin and the...
Was
and
that
the,
beautiful in those days?
Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Interesting stuff.
Yes.
So, atropine is a good one.
Yep.
So, that might be used in an example where you have very severe bradycardia.
Yeah.
So, you've got sinus bradycardia and you want to speed up the heart, you give them atropine.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly clinically, if, again...
It's also used in eye exams,
okay,
right, to dilate the pupil.
Okay, that would be for other reasons than glaucoma, I presume.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, some other drug... Have you got anything else you want to talk about with atropine?
No.
Okay. Some other drugs, these are the ones that I think is more clinically relevant,
yeah,
is upper tropium and tiotropium. So these are used in COPD, and so these.
What's COPD?
Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So this would be emphysema and chronic bronchitis.
Yeah,
I'm not sure they really use much at all in asthma.
Yeah.
Okay. But these drugs, because you're blocking the parasympathetic, we already knew that parasympathetic causes bronchoconstriction. So if you block that, you would get bronchodilation, and you definitely get less secretions.
Okay.
Which you don't want when you've already got problems with your lungs.
That makes sense.
The other one, which is, you pronounce it because I probably won't do a good job of it.
Hyoscyamine.
Okay. So this one is, at least in Australia, the brand name is called Buscopan.
Oh, yeah.
Which I used when I got severe deli belly.
What's that?
India.
You're pooping yourself, Matty.
Yeah.
Again.
Severe diarrhea. Gastroenteritis.
Yeah.
So I got it from a virus in India, and I ended up in hospital.
How do you think you got that?
I don't know. Quite a number of people got it on the trip I was on.
You're doing a lot of cadaveric dissections over there, weren't you?
No, that trip I was fine.
Uh-huh.
That was the first trip to India that I had this problem. But a significant amount of people that were traveling with me also had this. So it was viral.
So what did the Buscopan or hyoscyamine
do? It's an antispasmodic. So one side effect of having severe diarrhea is cramping pain.
Yeah.
Very painful.
Yeah.
It's not just emesis of the lower end.
Yeah.
It's the cramping.
Yeah.
And so this helped me significantly. As soon as I started taking
hyoscyamine
or Buscopan, the cramping pain went away.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a good drug that I at least can have experience of.
Well, that's great. It's good to see you still don't have deli belly. It makes me happy. We're done, Matty.
So we've covered everything?
Yep.
How long did that take us?
Longer than it should have, but it took us just under, well, we're hitting 50 minutes.
Well, that's pretty good.
That's good for us.
Do we do a final wrap-up, or are you happy
with
that?
No, I've done a final wrap-up, excluding the antagonist, but what we should do is housekeeping. This is where everyone turns off now because they don't care.
Because you talked for 5 minutes.
Okay, let me just very quickly say that Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's medical podcast is proudly brought to you by our spare time. And it's really hard for us to...
It's a good sponsor, that.
Yes. So we need... hopefully you found that the quality of this episode is a bit better. I know Matt's voice is very dull and low and
just
hushed.
Just my attitude's dull.
Yeah. And he gets overpowered by the Todorovic. In order for us to continue to deliver high quality, which we think, med ed podcasts, videos, because we have a YouTube channel, Dr. Matt, Dr. Mike's medical YouTube, and I've got an Instagram page now. Please go and follow at Dr. Mike Todorovic. That's at DrMiketodorovic. I need a better surname. You'll find med ed videos under 5 minutes there for you. You can ask me questions. I can do a video for you. More than happy to do that. Otherwise, you can support us on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/medicalpodcast and you can donate $1 a month, $5 a month or more. If you donate a certain value over time, we will give you some of our merchandise. Dr. Matt, Dr. Mike's medical education key rings, hats. We've got a hat that says Make Anatomy Great Again. That's
mugs.
Pretty cool. Mugs.
Has this picture of Michael's face?
Yes, very beautiful. So if you want to drink out of that, please feel free. Look, apart from that, thank you for listening. We love you all. Please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you don't think we're
worth... suggestions.
Well, and if you don't think we're worth a 5-star rating on iTunes, just don't give us a rating at all. And suggestions, email us at gubiosciences@gmail.com. That's GUBIOSCIENS. However you spell science, sciences@gmail.com.
Michael needs some neostigmide.
Yes,
I do. Or Dunpuzzle.
Yeah, Dunpuzzle. Dunpuzzle.
Dunpuzzle.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.